call to order the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. Today is the 20th of May, and we have three items on the agenda. House Bills 3367 and 2509 will have public hearings. I do not intend on working either of those bills today. And we will, I intend on working House Bill 2456, so long as we have all the members here and everybody's ready to vote on it. So,
Mr. Chair, I make a motion that.
So we're going to start out with opening up a public hearing on House Bill 3367. Representative Olson, if you could kick us off. Beth, what does this bill do, real briefly?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 3367 would require a proposed permanent or temporary recreational trail, for use by the public on land zoned for EFU uses to go through the conditional land use permitting process.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. This is I'm Andy Olson, state representative from the Albany area, but I really do appreciate this opportunity to be in front of you. I'm just going to briefly share just a little bit of the opening on this, and then I've got to move on. This bill stemmed from a project in Benton County where the county proposed constructing a bike path through miles of prime farmland. While the county ended up going through the land use process, the proposed bike path highlighted a dispute in current law as to whether land use permits were required for trails through land zoned for farm use. Given the significant interest in rails to trails projects, this bill is necessary to clarify that these recreational trail projects should go through the local land use process and ensure that impacted landowners have a forum to raise potential impacts and conflicts associated with these projects. House Bill 3367 would require recreational trails to go through the conditional land use permitting process. Under current law, it is not clear whether recreational trails are permitted outright in farm use zones or whether they must have a permit from local governing body before they are constructed. And House Bill 3367 clarifies that recreational trails require a land use permit, and the permit process gives neighboring landowners a form to provide evidence on impacts to their farming operations from the project and requires the local governing body to make a finding that the project will not significantly increase the cost of farming practices or force a significant change in farming practices in the area impacted by the project. Now, I have with me that they can describe it even more so, Mr. Chair and committee members, Tina Galloway from Stallbush Island Farms, Louise and Stan Snyder. I believe Louise is going to be sharing. She's one of the farmers, too, that's impacted, and Marianne Nash as well from the Farm Bureau will be coming up a little later, from my understanding, and can really fill in the gaps big time for
you. Okay. Well, thanks for kicking us off. I'll say that there seems to be a theme of bills coming over from a certain committee on the House. Oh, Mr. Chair, you're here. Just sailing across the House floor, and then they get over here, and then our emails light up. So we've got two of those bills up today. So we'll.
If you need some help,
we'll try to get to the bottom of it in the hearing. So,
Mr. Chair, is that the committee that has a really charismatic chair?
It is. He's particularly charismatic.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you. Let's see. So where are we here? Okay. So we've got all of our members here right now. So in case we're going to lose anybody, before we move on with the testimony, I'd like to open up a work session on House Bill 2456.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2456 would stipulate that a city's determination of the supply and the development capacity of lands proposed to be brought into the UGB must be based on an inventory of vacant and partially vacant lands and factors established by the commission. This bill you heard last Wednesday on 513, and there's no revenue and no fiscal impact.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2456 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Olson has moved House Bill 2456 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, are there any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries. And anybody want it?
Okay.
Senator Olson? Kind of loading you up with a lot of bills there, but we appreciate your service.
I get paid by the hour.
We'll close the work session on House Bill 2456, and we will return to our public hearing on House Bill
3367.
So, Representative Clem, are you here for 2509 or 3367? It's your bike path bill. I don't know that it's your bill, but I just... Okay, 2509. Okay. Well, we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2509. And while Beth tells us a little bit about what the bill does, the good chair will get ready to... tell us what's happening with this bill.
House Bill 2509A would authorize the Oregon Department of Agriculture to use mediators to help resolve coexistence conflicts among growers of biotech, conventional, and organic crops.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brian Clem, State Representative from Salem District 21, which is where we're sitting now. I don't know what to tell you about the emails. I'm going to outline what we went through, which was a two-session consensus process. We started in 2013 with Representative Holvey, Representative Hicks, and myself, and a group called the Center for Sustainable Law out of Eugene with Mary Beth, who is now Representative Buckley's L.A., and the Oregonians for Food and Shelter and the Department of Ag. We essentially came up with a mediation proposal in 2013 that would help when a grower thinks they're being harmed by a neighboring grower, have a tool to get the neighboring grower to show up in mediation when otherwise they may have no incentive. And in particular, the provisions that are now being complained about by certain groups that aren't the Center for Sustainability Law, but I think they're all on the same side of the GMO issue, were brought to us by the anti-GMO people saying we're worried that if a GMO company endangers our existence, that they won't come to mediation, and so we need some way to get them to come to mediation. Now the provisions in the emails I'm reading are being viewed the opposite as harmful, so I don't know what exactly to do about that. Maybe we can figure out some amendments, but this came from the anti-GMO community, particularly the Center for Sustainability Law is where the bill genesis was in 2013. We then shelved the bill at the request of Representative Buckley in particular because he told me he was afraid it would lead to the passage of seed preemption, so we killed the bill. That all happened anyway. It still passed. So then we had two bills about GMOs in our House bill this year, or our House committee this year. So we formed another work group to try and sort out, could we come up with some kind of coexistence zones or market production zones or some sort of zones to facilitate either buffers or pinning systems or something when there are problems between growers of different types. And two of your members, and I think Senator Hansel came as well, but Senator Denbrough, Senator Thompson, Senator Hansel, Representative Buckley's staff, Representative Helm, myself, Oregon Tilth, Farm Bureau, Friends of Family Farmers, the Department of Ag, and Oregonians for Food and Shelter all participated. We issued this consensus product, and it passed unanimously on the House, and now I realize everybody hates it. So I'm going to just do my best to address some of the concerns that I've heard. But the basic premise over these last 4 years was if you, as the bill says, if you are engaged in farming and you believe, a reasonable belief, that somebody near you is interfering with your practice, that you could then request that they come to try and mediate these disputes between you. And initially in our work groups, the discussion was, well, what's the incentive for a Monsanto to come to mediation when they're the ones infecting me? So we put in provisions that said if they don't show up or don't show up in good faith, then they would be at risk in a later lawsuit because they don't show up. So then now you have to sue them, and they would be at risk for their attorney fees. The concern seemed to be now the inverse, which is that Monsanto is going to believe that you, as an organic grower, are going to pull you into mediation because you're interfering with their crops, which I don't see how that could trigger the bill because an organic product is unlikely to ever have a scientific way to alter a GMO crop the way it could go the other way, but I don't think it can go this way. But anyway, the fear seems to be that Monsanto would use this to drag organic farmers and non-GMO farmers, like me, who is a non-GMO farmer. They would drag me into court and run out my dollars with extended mediation sessions. And that's not why we made the bill, but if we need me to make an amendment to make that clear, that's fine. The bill was designed to help people who felt that they had neighbors who were at no risk. While they were at risk of losing their market access or their certification, they were at risk, and their neighbors had no risk, so they wanted a hammer to make them come to mediation. So anyway, the other provision of the bill has to do that produced a fiscal was not the most exciting thing in the world, but we thought we could have OSU talk a little bit about coexistence and make some products available to talk about coexistence, and that has produced a $200,000 fiscal apparently. So I would bring an amendment to eliminate the discussions of coexistence because it was really the mediation part that was the most useful anyway, and I don't want to spend $200,000 on that. That people can figure that out amongst themselves apparently. The other provision that seems to now have some heartburn, but again, it came at the time from the Center for Sustainability Law, was a requirement that you go to mediation before going straight to court. And I think the thought was usually it's the little guy, not Monsanto, who's got the no money. So mediation would be a better way to resolve differences than trying to take on a big company in court. But I don't know that anybody in the work group really cared about that portion of the bill particularly. It was more the if you don't participate in mediation in good faith, there needed to be some way, some risk to you for not showing up to mediation. The part about mediation prior to ever going to court in the first place as a mandatory thing you had to try before you go to court, I don't really remember who even asked for that to be put in. So maybe somebody else who was in the work group can speak to that, but I don't remember who asked for that part. That part to me is not as important as the mediation. So rather than boxing with shadows, maybe I should stay a while and listen to what other people have to
say.
Might
be helpful.
Yeah, because again, this was designed to be helpful to people worried about being interfered with by GMOs, and if it's now being viewed as a tool against the very people who we were trying to get this product put together for the last 4 years, then we should either just kill it or discuss what amendments would be. I think a tool like this is pretty useful in other issues that are non-GMO related, like marijuana and hemp, or if you come out of the canola moratorium and you still have problems with each other, I would rather see some tool at the Department of Ag. To be clear, the Department of Ag has a mediation program already, and it typically just doesn't get used for this kind of stuff. But the reason for the bill was to add the disincentive in the incentive for people to go to mediation, that they have a mediation program, but if there's no reason to go because you're the one who is interfering with your neighbor, why would you show up? That was the whole premise. And so this bill would add on to their existing mediation program some risk that you might lose your attorney fees in court someday if you refuse to participate or refuse to participate in good faith and then it goes to court. Otherwise, you could just go back to the existing mediation program. But the thought was there needed to be some incentive to bring people in who otherwise had no reason to go, except you would think to be a good neighbor. And I'd like to think most people would go, but the concern was at the time there wouldn't be people who and ironically, actually, I do recall in talking to both groups in rooms independently, both groups from the GMO issue, this is pre-Jackson County ballot measure or anything, they both thought the other one would not show up to mediation. And so when I realized they both could agree to the same bill independently of each other because they both don't trust the other one, I said, okay, let's sponsor that bill. And then when we had the work group, everybody was on board. So I hope not everybody's fallen off now. I guess I'll find out in a second. But anyway, that's the history of this formerly non-controversial bill.
Thank you for that history. So if we don't have the bill, status quo is
there's a mediation program,
right?
And
there's just no incentive to use it.
There's no hammer if someone right. doesn't come. Yeah.
Okay.
The other issue, Mr. Chair, I might mention is it's come to my attention that the Department of Ag may be lifting a cap in another bill that's a Senate bill, so people might be nervous that there would be an unknown cost per hour for mediation. So what I would recommend is keeping the cap for this particular type of mediation so you know it's $30 an hour. Because in our work group, we were working off a set of numbers that was known, and I didn't realize they might change that. So that would be one way to make sure people don't get caught up in mediation with unending costs. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Can I just ask? There's also, and thanks for that. I think you know, from what I've heard, the cost issue is what, yeah. and the uncertainty of it is what are what's making people nervous. So maybe that's the right way to handle it. Section 3 is the one about seed, and that the Department of Ag will appoint a representative to accompany the farmer. That there was that whole other discussion in the work group.
Thank you, Senator. Yeah. Senator Edwards, Senator Denver, I forgot. This was the concern where you believe you've been harmed by your neighbor, and you've done some tests probably to lead you to believe that. Now they want to come onto your property and test your crops. Because maybe they don't believe your tests or whatever. They want to confirm for themselves that they either did or didn't damage you. This is protection for the person who thinks they got harmed to have a Department of Agriculture representative present so they don't, like, fake it and put some stuff on the ground and then test that. Like, so there's a chain of custody because, again, a lot of these folks don't trust each other that
trust
much.
Anybody.
Yeah.
No.
So that was added in, again, back in 2013 and again this time, to give the person who thought they'd been infringed on a neutral party, though I've read in the emails a lot of people don't feel the Department of Ag apparently is a neutral party anymore. And so I would like to also make clear the mediation services are provided by third-party mediation services who are not Department of Ag employees. So if people are concerned that the Department of Ag has been already taken over by Monsanto, these would be third-party mediation services, not Department of Ag employees. I also, again, would probably reiterate that a person has to believe that they were the one being interfered with. In the first, it says, if a person that is engaged in a farming practice has a reasonable belief that something nearby might interfere with them, that would be the trigger. So if you don't think you got interfered by anybody, you couldn't trigger the mediation. But if you did, then and you are making noise about the fact you were, either party could then ask for mediation.
Sir Thompson.
I just want to thank Rep. Clem and a lot of people that are sitting in the room also that attended, I don't know, 3 months worth of meetings just this session, not including the last session on this issue, worked really hard, and I thought they got the consensus. We're going to hear a little bit more mm-hmm. now later, but I think Rep. Clem deserves three kudos for the time he spent and all the hard work he spent.
Must not be reading emails then.
Oh, no, I read all about myself.
Yeah,
I don't even take out-of-state campaign donations yet. Somehow I'm owned by a variety of out-of-state companies, yet I have zero out-of-state campaign donations from any entity ever except for my brother. Individuals, maybe, but
ask
never a
foundation.
Company, never a PAC, never a group.
Yep. Ask about the foundation.
About which one?
Your foundation.
Yeah.
Do you have a server, too, that you've kind of buried someplace? I have a couple questions,
yes.
If you don't mind.
And for anybody watching online, this is good-natured kidding. This is not serious.
Yeah, that's right.
So we understand that this is a serious issue, and people have strong feelings about it. So let's
that's true.
Maintain
decorum.
Order and decorum here.
Representative Clem, just a few questions. Is there a linear equation to this where someone 5 miles down the road could make a claim against you?
The term we use, Senator, Mr. Chair, Senator, or Vice Chair Olson, excuse me, is nearby. Let me see what the exact language is.
Yeah, I read the nearby, but I didn't know if there was a proximity to that or.
No, I don't think so. trying to pick a number could be difficult, just depending on if it's okay. GMO stuff, it would be the distance gene flow is. If it's canola, could be the distance of a brassica. And the difference of opinion over, even in the brassica world, whether it's half a mile or 100 miles is yeah. broad. So we didn't try and pick a number.
Because okay.
We,
follow up, please.
Yeah, follow up.
Thank you. Question I have is, if there's an existing farmer and he's been farming for 20 years and a new farmer comes in next to him and decides that he wants to plant a crop that's not conducive to the crop that the existing farmer has, what's the existing farmer, if this happens to him, what's his recourse? You're going to go to mediation and say the mediator says, well, yeah, this new crop is going to be affected by your old crop, so you need to change your old crop. So what's his recourse to get by that? And is it going to cost him an arm and a leg to go to circuit court to get it adjudicated that he could still plant what he'd planted for 20 years?
Senator Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, I think one of the, again, I wish I could remember exactly who suggested, but one of the reasons we talked about going to mediation before you could even go to court was to try and settle these things at a lower cost. You know, in retrospect now, I'm not sure that provision, you know, makes sense, okay. You know, given some of the things people are worried about, like they need to go get injunctive relief right now, and now they're stuck in mediation for 300 days. I don't think the goal was to prevent access to the court, but it was to reduce cost or try and resolve the dispute. So let's say that part were out, and the farmer who had been there for a long time, I'll just use my own orchard, for example. So we are GMO-free, but we use pesticides sometimes. And we had a neighbor who moved in, and they were organic. And we were a little bit nervous, like, what is this going to mean? Do we need to remove some trees? Are they going to get their pests on us? Are we going to hurt their certification? That kind of thing. Nobody ever sued anybody. You know, we figured out what to do to right around the edges to deal with each other. But your question is, if they did sue me, how would this affect that situation? And the only real risk for me is the guy who was there first, is if they tried to get me to come to mediation because they said, like, our pesticides have hurt their organic certification. I will say, though, the Oregon Tilth, who also supported this bill, was in the work group and made it clear that inadvertent presence of a pesticide in a organic farm is not a way you can lose your certification. But let's say they thought they were going to lose market access because our something on our farm infected something on their farm, and they sued me for that, they could get their attorney fees more easily if they had attempted this mediation and I wouldn't go. So all it really does is add a carrot to get them to try and use mediation rather than just sue me straight up. So for me, I would view it as somewhat protective of the person who was there first, because at least my neighbor is likely to ask for mediation before they just sue me immediately, because they'll get their attorney fees automatically if they try mediation first. So I don't view it as hostile to the person who was there first. You definitely could argue that the fact that my brand new neighbor can force me to go to mediation even though I was there first is unfair. But, you know, we're going to have to live next to each other anyway, and if my practices, even though I was there first, are causing a problem, I would rather hear about it and go to mediation, even if necessary, than just get sued for it right off the bat.
Follow?
Yeah.
Follow. If the mediator determined that he didn't like what you were doing, although it's a set-in-stone farm practice,
yeah.
Don't you think that would be an imposition upon you and your ability to produce your product? To have to rely on this mediator telling you that you have to change your farm practices because of a neighbor?
Senator Edwards, or Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, I think that the mediator would not have the powers of, say, an arbitrator, you know, some sort who could tell me to do things differently. All they can do is really try and bring us together to resolve our differences, and they would have no, you know, authority to do something. My only risk in going to mediation is that I'm going to get talked into doing something I don't want to do by these other two people. But in the end, that's my choice. And my risk of not going is I could be sued and lose my attorney fees. So there is some more risk by the bill to getting sued and losing attorney fees, but I don't think the mediation part carries any more risk than, you know, to get me to change my practices. And I will tell you, I am very sympathetic to what you're saying in your question, because there's lots of things that have moved in next to our orchard over the last 100 years, a school, an organic grower, and we've had to change our practices, but you know, it's part of living in a community. So I don't begrudge people coming into, and I think Senator Thompson could talk about, you don't begrudge people coming into the Valley as long as they're willing to kind of work with you, and you know, and I have had people scream at me from, why are you out here on your tractor at 6 in the morning? And like, it's harvest time and we're trying to farm here. And it was some renter who was mad that I woke him up. And I, you know, there's only so much you can do about that, but it's part of life when you're out there.
Does the I'm not maybe as familiar with the mediation services as I should be. Do those result in, like, once they've mediated some sort of an agreement, does that then result in a contract that both sign, like, I will do this, I will do this type of a thing, or is it just a handshake type thing? Is there any legal process? And maybe our resident legal expert knows that better.
I did talk about that.
If you don't know, there'll be
I think
people.
There can be, but there needn't be.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I think the Department of Ag may have somebody here who could talk about what they
scanning
do.
Scanning the room, I don't see anybody from the department, or if they're from the department, I don't realize they're from the department. So,
I am a little nervous that everybody who's in the work group is not going to say anything, and they're all going to disappear,
no.
And it's just me now. So,
Mr. Chair, we've got some other people coming up, and I'm going to invite you to sit with us if you want to stay around.
Sure. That's a first.
Well, I may withdraw my positive comments if that's going to happen. But no. I don't think that the idea of requiring mediation to come before a court action was any one individual's idea. I mean, I think there was a kind of consensus, as I recall, that you know we wanted that to happen. I mean, we wanted to see court action avoided if possible.
Yeah.
And if mediation could help us get there, that would be great. But there's no guarantee, obviously, that mediation will resolve the conflict. And if it doesn't, then it'll have to go to court.
Senator Thompson.
Same opinion. That's what I thought I heard there, too.
Any other questions for the chair? Okay. If you'd like, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, just to respond to that last point, I think the concerns I'm reading about are more that if it becomes a huge barrier to an imminent need to get in court for some reason, we need to address that so it's not you've got a real serious problem. Someone's really being harmed and they want to get injunctive relief and now you have to go to mediation for the next 270 days. And I can see that as being a problem that we just didn't really think about in particular. Yeah.
Okay. You're welcome to sit over there. You're welcome to sit up here. Frankly, I would because
wherever you want.
I did not participate in these work group meetings. I was invited, and I know that there are a lot of them because every single time you guys met, I got an email calendar notice about the work group meeting. So I know you guys sat through a lot of meetings. That's why I was a little bit surprised when there was this big blow up. I don't know the issue as well. So if you want to sit up here with us, you're welcome to.
Why don't you join us for a time? That way, if you have questions, you can ask them.
Yeah.
So. Okay. So I do on.
Never done this.
Let's see. Notifying after mediation. Okay. So I want to bring up some folks that have signed up with perhaps a different perspective. So on this same bill, 2509. So Kelly Barnes, Brett Diamond, and Ivan Molesky. Yeah. Go ahead.
Chair Edwards and committee members, thank you for hearing our testimony.
Absolutely.
My name is Kelly Barnes, and I'm a citizen here representing our Family Farm Coalition. They were not able to be here today because literally as we speak, they're in court defending their right for GMO-free crops. So essentially, our Family Farm Coalition opposes this bill for several primary reasons. One, they believe that crops that are damaged by GMO contamination should not be forced into mediation. While I just heard testimony that supports the idea of mediation saving money later due to litigation, it also is something that is already a tool that some farmers can use. The question is whether a farmer should be forced into this mediation when they already have that tool that they can utilize. House Bill 2509 would essentially force farmers who had their crops contaminated by GMOs into a somewhat vague and undefined ODA mediation process. I did take the time to read the text and the first amendments of this bill to understand how this process would be defined. It does appear to be somewhat vague in terms of how the mediation process would work out. While it is true that there would be third-party mediators that are essentially neutral, ODA still has the authority and the regulation to control this process. That could be a time process. There's no statute of limitations that are defined, so this is still a bit unknown. Also, as mentioned earlier, if a farmer needed to take quick legal action to prevent crop contamination, this bill would prevent that as a practical matter and instead engage in a very time-consuming and as of yet undefined process. We've heard today that ODA may lack the credibility to administer a neutral mediation process related to GMOs, and this can be seen historically as ODA has generally turned a deaf ear towards the threats facing farmers who practice traditionally. We could see such examples historically where some of the ag business investments in the state have been protected over those of small and medium-sized farmers. This can be seen specifically when the Willamette Valley was open to GMO canola, and then the legislature had to step in to allow some guidance on that process. In addition, another example of this is recently when Jackson County farmers asked ODA specifically for help to address the fact that seed farmers were having to pull their crops. Essentially, ODA turned an ear. House Bill 2509 would directly interfere with farmers' ability to enforce Jackson County's ban on GMOs. It would require any party that believes that GMOs are interfering with their farming to be engaged in this ODA-controlled process. I'm not here to say that ODA is necessarily a bad organization or that they're not capable of having some influence in this process, but again, historically, the trend has not been supportive of traditional farmers. We're particularly concerned that House Bill 2509 puts into statute, quote, to assist the parties in attempting to reach agreement on issues regarding the coexistence of agricultural lands, end of quote. Jackson County voters and the 150 farmers that represent our Family Farms Coalition strongly believe that coexistence of GMO and traditional crops is simply not possible in a narrow valley. Citizens in the state do believe that the state should step in and allow better guidance and regulation on these processes. That is still to be determined, and many of us do not believe that this bill is a solution, but rather a complication. Thank you for hearing my testimony.
Thank you. We'll go through the entire panel and then have questions. So.
Excuse me. I'm needed in another hearing, so I may slip back and forth if that's okay. Am I allowed to leave and come back in?
You're allowed, but you might not be invited back up. So
that's fine.
If you need to go, I mean, do you need to go right now?
It's a legislative concept that I wrote, so I am required to be there.
Okay. Well, then, before you go, because I understand conflicts. And so does anybody have any questions for Kelly? So I guess I have a question. And you said that this would interfere with Jackson County's ability to exercise control. Could you expand on that sentiment?
Well,
more?
Essentially, as you know, there was an ordinance that was passed, I believe it was a 66% vote, that banned GMO crops from Jackson County. If there was an example of a potential mediation conflict where a traditional farmer was brought into that process, they would essentially, this bill is mandating that they first go through a mediation. Our family farms believe that mediation is a possibility, but it should not be mandated. And that's essentially the question that they have.
Yeah, go ahead.
So thank you. I just was reading a little bit closer the 270 days, and what it says is if there is a court action and they haven't tried mediating, then within 270 days or 9 months roughly from when they filed, then they need to go to mediation. But it doesn't actually terminate their court action or their filing anyway.
Right. I think part of the concern was the timeline. As you mentioned earlier, that possible concern just hadn't been considered. So if there's a need for more expedient timing of a litigation matter, and I'm not an attorney, I'm a citizen, then there's concern that this mediation process will take so much time, and it's under the regulation and control of ODA, that it may not be timely enough, for one reason. And then, in addition, one of the larger concerns is statute. And as I'm learning this legislation session, statute is really important. So essentially, the way this bill is worded in its text, the concern of changing a statute to allow a coexistence that ODA would have authority of is something that traditional farmers have concern about. There is a belief by some farmers that coexistence is not possible, and I hear a lot of historical reference about coexistence of farmers hundreds of years, but biotechnology has changed, and coexistence is a different sort of example than it used to be hundreds of years ago. And if you think about the economic cost to the state, you know, we only have to look back as far as the wheat situation, where Asian markets shut down, you know, some of the crops coming from Oregon that had GMO contamination or the risk thereof. So this is still a very complex process that needs to be worked out, perhaps on another avenue rather than this bill.
Okay, Senator Przanski, and then we'll come back.
Mr. Chair, this is, I guess, more of a general comment or something we could be looking at if we're thinking about moving the bill. We could always put in notwithstanding language that would actually allow for someone that needed to get injunctive relief or seek court action or intervention, so that if there's a quote-unquote mandatory requirement to do mediation, that would not preempt them from being able to take whatever steps they feel are necessary on a more urgent basis. And I think that might help out some. I've talked to one of the other individuals, so we're going to hear more testimony, but I know that Kelly's going to be leaving. Just put that out there, that I think there's ways to make certain. I think the goal in the legal community is trying to get people to sit down together and talk. And if you can do that and work things out, great. But at the same time, it shouldn't put you in a situation that you're going to basically suffer the consequences of not doing mediation because you're taking other steps you think are so important that you could be losing your livelihood.
And if I may comment to that, I think that would be an excellent amendment, but there are still additional concerns outside
right.
of just that amendment.
No, I understand. I just knew that you're leaving. We're going to hear a lot more.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Clem, did you have a question that
was
before
just
Kelly
say,
leaves?
I'm fairly certain we'll get a lawyer to answer this, but I'm fairly certain they can run on parallel tracks. It says after the court action, then you've got 270 days after the action is filed to participate in mediation. And so we could clarify it for sure, but I don't think it terminates your action. It just says while you're suing, then you've got 9 months to try mediation as well. And then if you don't, it just says then not that your court case is terminated, just says a court may impose sanction against the party that fails to participate or act in good faith. I think that was the design of the deal of the bill. I actually had misread it earlier when I was speaking, to require mediation first. I don't think that's the case. It's to require mediation at some point in the first 9 months of the lawsuit was the goal of the provision. And I am very sensitive to the wheat issue. You might Google my name in Monsanto, and you will see that I called on the state to sue Monsanto in that situation. I know now apparently I'm not quite the enemy of Monsanto, but at that time nobody was really happy me back at Monsanto headquarters, I assume.
Thank you for that comment. My point about the wheat wasn't so much that particular example, but just that there might be downstream economic effects on the state and farmers that we don't yet recognize by this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank
you. Go ahead.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Edwards and members of the committee. My name is Brett Diamond, and I am here today on behalf of Oregonians for Responsible Food and Farming to encourage you to oppose HB 2509 for several important reasons. HB 2509 effectively forces farmers that have had their crops contaminated by GMOs into a vague and undefined mediation process that the Oregon Department of Agriculture would orchestrate. While mediation can be a valuable and worthwhile tool for resolving conflict, forcing farmers into mediation is both unfair and unnecessary. Under current law, any farmer whose crops are damaged by the actions of another are free to enter into mediation if they choose to do so. But farmers should be free to take the legal course of action of their choosing without being forced into mediation by the government. Oregonians for Food and Shelter, who represent Monsanto and the other chemical companies that produce and sell GMO seeds, are in support of this bill as they are likely hoping that forced farmer mediation will result in reduced contamination settlement costs for their clients. Having your crops ruined and your reputation tarnished by a GMO contamination incident is bad enough, but HB 2509 will force farmers into time-consuming mediation with the threat of being forced to pay the trespassers' legal fees held over their heads. 2509 does not set any time limits on how long the mediation process would last or how much it could cost in fees. This would all be determined at the ODA's discretion with no input from farmers or oversight from lawmakers. We also oppose HB 2059 because it puts the ODA in a position of mediator on an issue where it has no credibility as a neutral party. Just a few years ago, the ODA pushed to open the Willamette Valley to GMO canola production, which would have destroyed tens of millions of dollars in specialty seed production and devastated many family farmers. The ODA seems to have aligned themselves with the biotech companies and their head-in-the-sand belief that coexistence between GMO farmers and non-GMO farmers is actually a viable course of action when there is clear evidence that coexistence is simply not possible. As we saw in 2013, when illegal GMO wheat was found growing in eastern Oregon, the impacts upon the entire U.S. wheat supply were swift and dramatic as tens of millions of dollars in wheat sales to Asia and Europe were canceled. And while Oregon narrowly averted a complete economic disaster with the GMO wheat contamination incident, the same cannot be said for the corn and rice farmers in the southeastern U.S. who had their crops contaminated by GMOs, which resulted in billions, billion with a B, of dollars in legal settlements, cleanup costs, and long-lasting damage to the reputation of the region's food supply. As we speak, GMO company Syngenta is being sued for over $1 billion by U.S. corn growers who had their corn shipments to China rejected because of GMO contamination, and China just recently began rejecting alfalfa imports from Oregon and Washington due to contamination by GMO alfalfa. Lastly, HB 2059 attempts to create funding for OSU to propagate the myth that coexistence between GMO crops and non-GMO crops is the best available option for our farmers when there is clear evidence that coexistence is a failed policy that has cost U.S. farmers billions of dollars. For all these reasons, I encourage you to oppose HB 2509. It's bad for our farmers, and it's bad for the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Ivan.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, Ivan Maluski with Friends of Family Farmers. I find myself in an odd position on this situation because we were part of the work group that discussed some of these issues. But at this point in time, we've moved our position. We were initially neutral on the bill, and we are now opposed because of, you know, some of the discussion that's being sort of brought out in public here today. When this legislation first presented itself in our discussions, which were, you know, the work group in part was focused on some regulatory approaches around GMO crops. That was our main interest in being there. And this idea started to circulate. And in some ways, you know, we share the belief that mediation can be a constructive way to resolve disputes without going to court. But as we've sort of looked at this a little more deeply, it strikes us that, you know, mediation should really be a choice that farmers make and not a mandated situation. And as we've looked at the implications of the bill, we're concerned that there may be some potential costs to farmers that were not anticipated when this was initially discussed. And I will just say that because of the work group process and the deadlines on the House side, there was not a robust, vigorous discussion of the implications of this bill in either the House committee or on the House floor. So I really do appreciate you taking the time to go slow on this legislation here in the Senate, because this is really where the legislature as a whole, frankly, has an opportunity to weigh in a way that going to really look at the issues more closely than what was able to be had on, at least by the legislature and the House side. So I guess I'll just flag a few key issues here. While mediation can be a good choice for some farmers based on their particular circumstances, this bill essentially takes away that choice by compelling farmers to engage in potentially costly and time-consuming mediation with the risk of, we could call it an incentive, but it's also a risk of high court costs and attorney's fees. And one of the things that we did not realize when this bill was under discussion initially is that in a separate bill, the Oregon Department of Agriculture is amending its mediation statute this year. It's actually, I believe it already passed this committee. It may have been on the Senate floor today. I wasn't tracking it that closely. But one thing we did not realize, but they lifted the longstanding cap on fees in that bill to be allowed to be made by rule by the director of the Department of Agriculture. So that's really a game changer of a situation for us, because we were under the standing in part that mediation was typically very low cost at $30 per hour per party. What this could mean ultimately is we don't know what the costs are going to be. I don't think anyone has a way of knowing right now, because this is going to be a rulemaking process that's administered by the ODA. They may have perhaps different sets of fees for different types of mediation. Given that these issues around GMOs can be complicated, it's not out of the question for this to be a higher cost than other types of mediation. So that's certainly a concern for us. This could run into the over $100 per hour, hundreds of dollars per hour. And you may find that in a complicated mediation, you may actually have to have a lawyer or a law firm retained as well. So your costs and effect are going up significantly. So given that ODA is in the process of refining its mediation program and its cost through rule, and the fees are unknown, we would believe it would be inappropriate at this time to require mediation in these types of situations as outlined in 2509. The high cost could ultimately disproportionately burden small farmers or those without significant access to significant economic resources. Those significant resources come in through a pro bono law firm, or they could come in through a multinational company willing to provide legal services. So, in essence, it could unduly harm smaller folks or folks who don't have a lot of resources to bring to the table in the mediation. And again, as I noted, in the case of genetic engineering, it's likely going to be advisable to have an attorney walking you through the mediation process as well. So, without any sort of cost containment or requirement for short duration process, this could really start to add up on the costs. And so further, the requirement in section 2, sub 2, that parties in a court action engage in mediation, we're concerned could lead to a situation where essentially the Department of Agriculture intervenes at the request of one party to force mediation during a time-sensitive court action. This could ultimately derail resolution of time-sensitive issues and those seeking justice in the situation. Now, while it may be the case that ostensibly you could concurrently be involved in court action and mediation, we're not sure exactly how that's going to play out on the ground, and it may lead to a situation where an injunctive relief is delayed because of the thought that everyone's involved in mediation. Let's see how that plays out. So that's a provision that is still of a lot of concern to us in terms of how it's written. And ultimately, in those time-sensitive situations, that's when you actually have justice delayed, and that could be really problematic for the farmers involved. So in the end, given that ODA has a voluntary mediation program, which they're revising at this time, we're not sure that this bill it's essentially a solution in search of a problem, because while there's certainly coexistence conflicts out there, we think the bigger issue, frankly, is some of the regulatory clarity that ODA needs in terms of how do we manage some of these issues. I spent the better part of 12 months on the governor's task force on genetic engineering, as did, I'm sure, some of the folks who are going to come up after this. We talked about a lot of different measures. We've discussed some of them here in the legislature, and we haven't seen progress on some of those issues. So it's frustrating, because we believe that there are some really common sense solutions that ODA could be taking, and that as far as the mediation process goes, we think at this point it would be better to leave it as it is, leave it to be a voluntary process that farmers can engage in, have ODA make that available to folks. Perhaps one way to incentivize mediation is to make it voluntary, but contain the cost specifically for genetic engineering-related disputes. And so you both contain costs, but you also still make it voluntary. That might be perhaps a way to go as well. So let's allow ODA's mediation program to be used as farmers as they see fit. And so we'd respectfully urge you to oppose this bill at this time. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Ivan. So the cost, and I was just looking up what exactly, it was House Bill 2444. That changed the fee structure.
That's right.
And I was just pulling it up. Beth, do you?
We passed today.
We passed it today. I'm trying to remember exactly, because if I remember right, it was characterized as having mostly to do with was it farm labor?
Mr. Chair and committee members, there's a document that's available on OLS under the House Bill 2444 that was submitted by the Department of Agriculture that outlines their testimony and that the majority of the current cases that they're dealing with, approximately 90% are labor disputes. And they, during testimony, I believe, expressed a concern that given that they had other funding, that the majority of, or that some of the farm workers who participate in the program because of the labor disputes would be unable to pay for the cost to provide the service if they were required to pay, was a testimony that we heard.
Okay. Questions, comments? Yeah, Sir Dembro.
So, you know, as we discussed in the work group, Ivan, you know, I think the sort of typical case that we talked about where mediation would be warranted would be, you know, if there were two crops that where there was a possibility of cross-contamination, and the desired outcome of the mediation would be an agreement to, you know, about distance at which the crops would be kept separate or the timing at which the crops would be grown. And those seemed like laudable goals. I mean, if they worked out, I don't think there was any talk about compelling people to stay in mediation. I mean, I think we heard from the ag people that most of those mediation sessions just are a single session, you know, where things are worked out, a two-hour, three-hour session. So, I mean, I think that's what I was envisioning from this. I suppose we could amend it to make that more explicit, and, you know, it would meet, you know, the way I had been thinking about it. But, you know, I guess, you know, the question that was posed before about how this could be used to hurt a person who's trying to keep their crop GMO-free, as you see, what would be a scenario in which that would play out to the detriment of that person?
Sure. Chair Edwards, Senator Dembro, we heard the same comments from the Department of Agriculture in terms of the oftentimes quick and low-cost resolution. While that's somewhat reassuring, we become more concerned that in these more complicated cases around genetic engineering that it may not look like those typical mediation cases. And so we're just – the lack of clarity around that has us concerned. Regarding your second question, we've had some organic farmers bring up a concern that, for example, you may be growing a certain crop, you're not using insecticide or herbicide to treat your crop, and a farmer a couple miles away says, hey, I've got a bigger insect or disease problem because of your organic practices. You're doing nothing wrong. You're operating under the federal organic standards. But even if that second farmer who believes you're causing an insect or disease problem doesn't necessarily have a legal leg to stand on, the way this is written is you could essentially say, I want to mediate, and that the first farmer or the original farmer, the organic farmer, would be compelled to go into the situation. Now, they may want to hedge their bets and say, I'm not likely to lose in court here, so I'm going to not participate. But, you know, it may also be a situation where they're very scared by the process. If you've just been essentially given a letter that, you know, mediation is essentially required in this situation, or you could face attorney's fees or higher costs, and you may find that people either have to then retain an attorney to defend themselves in the mediation process, or ultimately settle, or you know, make some payment, make some adjustment to their practices to accommodate this issue that's come up. So that's a concern that we hadn't heard earlier that's come up more recently. So that would be one example where hypothetically something like this could be used against someone in a way to sort of force them to change some practices that otherwise aren't in any way illegal.
So would, in that instance, I mean, so I'm hearing one of the concerns is the potential the potential that the process is undefined, it's open-ended, could drag on for a long time. Senator Dembro just spoke to that. He believed that the intent was, and that the reality is that these are usually very short, you know, one meeting, maybe two meeting type things. I mean, if the risk, the other risk is that you're going to be taken to court anyway. Is that, or am I not understanding the legal landscape properly here? So you can go to mediation and then go to court, or you can go to mediation, or you can just go to court, right? Is that?
I think so, yeah. As I read,
I know you don't want to, you don't appear to want to say yes, but is that right or not?
Chair Edwards, this bill does not restrict your right to go to court.
Okay.
However, it may, the mediation,
or your right to defend yourself in court.
Or defend yourself in court. The mediation, however, could be strategically timed to impact your ability to be successful in court. The requirement that once one party essentially serves notice that they want to mediate, you know, you have to mediate, otherwise you face a higher legal risk. If that's in a time-sensitive process where you're looking for injunctive relief, we're concerned that could really cause problems. And so that's an element of this that...
So does the bill specify that the... I'm looking down the dais or to you, because you guys have worked on this issue a lot more than I... So does it specify that there has to be a positive outcome to the mediation, or does it specify you must engage in mediation? You could go, show up to the mediation, give them the finger, walk out, and then proceed.
Chair Edwards, you have
to. That's what I'm wondering.
You have to act in good faith. That's one of the requirements.
Okay.
So
if you talk for an hour, then give them the finger. That might be good faith. But if you walk in and give them the finger before you even sit down, then maybe that's not good faith.
Possibly. And I would say
legal
this.
Term.
In addition, you know, let's have a scenario where it's one session that lasts 10 hours long, 10 hours long. And the cost that ODA sets by rule is $150 per hour. And you have to retain an attorney at another $150 to $200 an hour. Suddenly, this one-day session is costing you thousands of dollars to deal with. So that's even before you have the opportunity. So, to then take it to the next level, if that's where it's going to go, if, you know, you decide mediation isn't working, let's go to court. So that's the issue in terms of some of the cost and time containment pieces, is that you may still be putting people in a situation of, you know, maybe I should just pay this person several thousand dollars to get the, you know, get this over with, and because that may be a more cost-effective way to go. So, you know, when this was under discussion, we were obviously looking at a variety of different scenarios. I think that there are other scenarios that can also be envisioned. That's why I guess at this point we would prefer to stick with the ODA's voluntary program. Maybe there's ways to make it more friendly to these types of cases. And that might be a way to sort of go and view this in more of a way of how do we make the ODA mediation program serve as a potential pilot project for these kinds of things. I mean, I'm not aware yet of any farmers suing individual farmers over GMO crops at this point in time. But so it's not clear how widely this will be used in the first place. However, the way that this, there's some concern this could actually lead to more sort of these actions, given the kind of the broadness of how it's written, it could go both ways. So, again, I'll just circle back. You know, we've got some concerns. I think that our concerns could be resolved if we stuck with the ODA's voluntary program, and if we wanted to make some clarifications of that and how it could best be used for these types of situations to make it to facilitate folks going to mediation without requiring them absolutely. That might be a better way to go.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Yeah, Senator Olson.
You've got me totally confused. Requiring. I go out and I say that there's a problem. And I go to you and I say there's a problem. And you go, no, there's not a problem. And I go, well, I could ask the Department of Agriculture to come in and mediate. It says to assist the parties in attempting to reach an agreement. That's what it is. And it says if a party to a dispute refuses to allow the department to attempt mediation of the dispute and subsequently is the losing party in an arbitration or court action, now we're in arbitration, or the court may award the prevailing party costs and reasonable attorney fees. So I don't see where that's mandatory that you have to go into arbitration. It says you can ask them to help you. That's exactly what their program is. You can ask them to help. Then it goes on a little further. It says if a court action arises, which you've already got a lawyer because you got a court action, and then the parties of the action have not previously allowed the department to attempt mediation of the dispute, the parties must participate in the department mediation process. So you've already filed a court action.
So now they're just trying to say, let's try to mediate it before the court goes in and blows everything up. So I don't get where you say that it's mandatory that people have to go into arbitration. You've got me confused.
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, the second provision that you mentioned, that sounds like a requirement to us. One party says, I want to mediate, you have to go as part of this, if you're already in a court action. Regarding the first section, no, you could refuse for certain, but you also put yourself potentially at greater legal risk or greater financial risk if you refuse to do that. So that's why, you know, we describe this in part as an incentive, but we're concerned that it may actually be more of a push into the situation where that could actually create situations where you're paying more costs and potentially situations where people are trying to mediate over issues that previously hadn't. There's no real legal backing to.
I think Senator Przanski is wishing that this would have been in his committee.
Yeah.
Judiciary Committee.
This could have been there.
We'll move it.
You can do that referral.
Yeah. Representative Klein.
On the Section 2, if a person that is engaged in a farming practice has a reasonable belief that the planting, growing, or harvesting of an agricultural or horticultural commodity on nearby land might interfere with or is interfering with the farming practice, how could a non-GMO grower interfere with a GMO grower? Like the pesticide thing I get, but is there a situation where a non-GMO grower could interfere with a GMO grower under that language and trigger the reasonable belief they got interfered with?
Chair Edwards, Representative Clem, I'm trying to think on the fly of a situation specific to GMO. I mean, my example was conventional versus organic in that case. You could substitute GMO for conventional in the case I gave earlier with the organic situation. I'd have to think a little more deeply. I guess part of our concern is when you're in a situation where you're imagining all the scenarios under which this could apply, it gives us pause that we're not, you know, let's be sure we know what we're doing here. So I'll be happy to kind of talk with you more, but I think that the way in which it would be most relevant to the GMO specifically is if you were growing a GMO seed crop in which your seed purity was just as important as the non-GMO growers, you know, issue, or they were growing, say, an open pollinated, letting their chard go to, you know, pollination. You were growing a GMO sugar beet seed, so you may be at risk of contamination because your market is growing Roundup Ready sugar beet seed. So that might be a scenario in which a GMO grower felt that a non-GMO practice was harming them.
Yeah. I just want to just make one comment because I know we're about to finish up. I think I somewhat flippantly refer to my either alliances or not with GMO people. The truth of the matter is I am totally ambivalent on GMOs personally. Like the Arctic apple that might not turn brown, I may want to grow those someday. I don't know. We don't right now because a lot of our markets don't want it, but I don't have an open hostility or any love for GE one way or the other. It's just a scientific process that some of them I hear about and I don't like, and I think I'm opposed to that. And other ones I hear about where they put vitamin D into rice and it helped a bunch of people in Vietnam, I say, okay, that sounds pretty good. So I personally could care less. I don't have an ideological bent. It was just that the anti-GMO people asked for a lot of these provisions. That's what's confounding me so much about it, was this was backwards 3 years ago, and we had a bunch of people worried about being infested by GMOs come and say we need some tools, and now it's somehow flipped to a tool the other direction, and that's the frustration you're getting from me, whereas personally I'm ambivalent on GMO or non-GMOs. I know not everyone is ambivalent on that, but I personally am.
Any other questions for the panel? Thank you both for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we're going to call up Barry Bouchou and Greg Loberg and Scott Dahlman. And this is the last panel that is signed, or the last of folks that have signed up. So if anybody else wants to testify on this particular bill after these three gentlemen, we'll have one last chance, and then we'll move on to the next bill. So go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. My name is Scott Dahlman. I am the policy director for Oregonians for Food and Shelter. We were one of the participants both 2 years ago when Representative Klim was working on this bill and then in the work group this year. I must say I'm actually quite disappointed right now from some of the things I just heard after putting in a lot of time and effort to come out with something that we thought would work and something that we felt was a solid compromise, and while not being perfect, was something that we all felt could help foster coexistence. And I guess that's part of what you've heard today, is that there's a disbelief by some that there's room for all types of agriculture in Oregon, and we would definitely disagree with that. We think there is room for all types of agriculture in Oregon and that they can exist together, and that this bill helps to foster that. That was the entire point of this concept, was to create another step where you would bring growers together with the opportunity to try to work out what might be a potential conflict. What we did like about the idea is that it is kind of open-ended. It allows two neighbors to go in with a third party and try to identify some areas that they can work together. With a lot of these issues, it might be able to be something as simple as communicating your planting dates with your neighbor and planting at different times. When it comes to corn, that's a simple thing and it's a great solution. You can't get a court to tell a farmer to do that, but you can bring two growers into mediation and get something like that done. That's why we're supporting this. We think that having an incentive for both growers to be there is good, but as Senator Olson pointed out so well, if you do not believe there's a problem, there is nothing requiring you to go into this. We never saw this as something that would make the court process any more difficult. It was simply a step along the way to see if the problem could be addressed without having to go through a long, onerous court process. So we are continuing to support it. Another good thing that I want to mention is we believe that it will also help us to identify where and if a lot of these problems actually exist out there, because we hear a lot about these conflicts that are out there, but we don't actually see it happening in reality, and this would give us a way to kind of track what's going on out there and then down the road to see if something else needs to be done. But in the meantime, we think it's a good bill and we urge you to support it.
Thank you.
Barry insists on taking the third of three spots here. Greg Loberg, Chairman Edwards and committee members, and Chair Klim. I work at West Coast Beet Seed Company. I was part of the legislative work group. I probably was on the work group as a member of the Willamette Valley Specialty Seed Association. I'm in favor as well of course, House Bill 2509. The work group consisted of supporters and opponents of biotechnology, and at the time all were in favor of discussing conflict or even the appearance of conflict. So there are definitely are ideological differences on whether or not genetically engineered crops can coexist with non-GE counterparts or with any crops at all. This legislation would be helpful at bringing together parties that need to coexist in order to resolve conflict or the perception of it. After all, we can't move the land. We have to move towards coexistence. Oversight by the Department of Agriculture, I think, is a good thing. It provides a forum in which to evaluate assumptions by either side, perhaps not knowing fully what the other side is doing or is intending to do or what markets they're entering into. I think that the Department of Agriculture can help develop objective information and utilize that to resolve the issue. This process should improve communications among all stakeholders, GE, non-GE, and organic producers. Like Scott just said, I think it's open-ended enough and allows opportunity to develop the concept of mediation. If we come out with too many rules to it, it might also not function. And I'm also here in part to be able to answer questions around my particular area of seed production expertise. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, my name is Barry Bashu, and I'm the president of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. My wife and I are small farmers up near Sandy, Oregon. We raise a variety of crops, none of which are GE. That's by choice, not by ideology. We're a representative of majority of the farmers of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. We're all family farms. 97% of Oregon's farms are family farms. We all recognize that there's a value in all forms of production agriculture regardless. I was fortunate enough to serve on the USDA's AC21 Committee, Agriculture and Biotechnology in the 21st Century. After almost 2 years of meetings with a very broad diversity of groups of folks representing both ideological ends of the spectrum, the one thing that committee continued to agree to was that coexistence does work, that it can work. We reiterated that at a meeting more recently in North Carolina at the invitation again of the Secretary. The same broad group plus a large number of other public stakeholders met and had continual discussions about what USDA is currently doing regarding coexistence, what they propose to do with coexistence, and I think that makes it patently clear that the industry as a whole, and I don't just mean corn and soybeans and hogs, I mean the wide, various diverse agricultural interests recognize that coexistence does work. I think I entered into the work group. I was also part of the GMO task forces appointed by the previous governor. I entered the work group in good faith, hoping that there would be something that we could agree to, that we could come out with, that would provide some solutions, at least to find out whether or not the currently only anecdotal information actually has some basis. And we thought that there was an opportunity through mediation to do that. I entered it in good faith. I left it in good faith. I'm a little disappointed that folks have not necessarily followed that same path. But that's a personal choice, not for me to comment on. I think maybe the bigger picture here, maybe the sadder part for me, is that there's folks who apparently don't want to work with their neighbors. I think that's a particularly onus thing for an agricultural industry in Oregon that is so incredibly diverse, and something that I'm particularly proud of is that diversity. And it's the reason that Oregon is recognized worldwide as a producer of high-end crops of all forms of agricultural production. To hear that folks don't want to sit down, don't want to work with their neighbors, I think is particularly disappointing to me. We all have challenges. We all have neighbors. We all have different opinions on what should happen on farms. Those of us that live closer to urban areas have just as many issues with our neighbors and I think Representative Clem pointed that out, with neighbors that don't understand agriculture, don't like noise, don't like dust, don't like grease cannons, all the things that many of you folks are hearing about. But we managed to deal with them by talking across the fence and saying, what are we going to do about this particular issue that we have? Sometimes there are neighbors that don't want to do that. This mediation bill gives us an opportunity to say, okay, look, if we can't sort it out across the fence amongst ourselves, let's at least go to somebody that can sit down with us and figure out some common ground. That's all this bill does. I'm quite amazed at some of the iterations that have been put to this bill about what it may do or may not do. It seems fairly logical, fairly straightforward, and frankly, I applaud the chairman of the work group that put this together to try and meet common ground. And what, as Greg said, was a particularly ideological split. And this was one of the things that came out of that we all, at least at the time, agreed to. So I urge you to support this bill. And I hope that you can see your way through to moving this through a work session so that we come out of something with this legislative session that will give all of us some opportunities to move forward on this particularly important issue. Thank you very much, and I'll take any questions you have.
Okay. Senator Przanski.
It's not really for the panel, because I think you already noted someone from the Department of Ag is not here. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Was in the work group, was there any discussion about them being able to take on the workload? And I know that there's a program, but now we're potentially, if it goes some type of mandatory, what they're going to need to do, is this more FTE, or can you give us some insight on that?
Yes, Chair Edwards, Senator Przanski. The conversation with the department was that they didn't anticipate that it was going to add a lot for them, because at the end of the day, they really just facilitate it. So they have the contract mediators who they refer people to. And basically their job ends after they call the two parties together and connect them with the mediator. Okay. So it's not substantial workload for them because they're not doing any of the mediation. They're really just helping pull the groups together and connecting them with the mediator.
One follow-up. Knowing that we passed House Bill 2444 today, and apparently the testimony we heard earlier is that it lifted the cap off of what the fees would be, was there a discussion in the work group as to was this necessary to ensure that the facilitators that are the mediators that are going to be facilitating this needed to have more flexibility what their cost or charging would be?
Chair Edwards, Senator Przanski, I do not recall any conversation around that. We hadn't talked about that bill at the time, and we just kind of talked about general dollar amounts, about what it generally cost or what the department thought mediation would cost for these types of things. But there was no discussion specifically about the cap or the hourly rate or anything like that.
Okay, thank you.
And I will note that the 2444 not only raised the cap, but it also eliminated the floor, because there was a cost recovery provision, and that was the testimony that we had on that fee bill earlier in however many weeks ago, a couple weeks ago, to pass the floor today, was that it's mostly around farm worker disputes, mm-hmm. Farm labor disputes, and the provision in statute that they had to recover the cost on workers that don't make enough money to really be able to afford the mediation services was one of the reasons that we had removed the floor out of that bill. And all of the testimony that we had was focused on that. I hear some of the concerns. I will note that the relating clause is big enough on this one relating to mediation of agricultural disputes that I think we, if the committee chose to, we could address those some fee issues if there was some rejiggering, but we would need to get in touch with the department and kind of, you know, run the trap line there as well. So, Senator Denbrough.
Yeah, sure. You know, I will say that, as I recall the end of the work group, we did reach a consensus, but it was a very conceptual consensus. I mean, it wasn't as if we had the final bill in front of us, as I recall, or if we did, I didn't read it. How's that for true confession?
Yeah.
I don't remember exactly. So, you know, I would be open if there's some tweaking that needs to be done here to, you know, to protect, you know, for cost containment and things like that, because I don't remember that being really an issue.
Yeah.
So I think one thing I did mention, actually, this would probably be helpful for people to understand. There was a Senate bill that was introduced by the governor's office that was sitting here. Representative Buckley had other bills, and they were more about creating these kind of districts. And then within these districts, I think they were both called market production districts in both bills. So we actually took those two bills to talk about districts. Then we were sort of in an impasse, like what would trigger the districts. So we went to this because I knew this one had once been mediated, had once been agreed to by all parties in a previous session. So we looked at the old bill. We had a hard time finding actually the old bill. We looked through many amendments. We finally found it. And everybody then looked at it again, agreed to it. And then we started talking again about the market production zones. And actually, if I remember right, we thought it would be, this is such a great idea that we should make everybody go to mediation before we start setting up market production zones, which is particularly sad because now we don't even have the same people who are still trying to talk about those next steps of market production zones. We have another bill in House Rules. We're still trying to get there on that. And this was the underpinning to go to that is now falling apart, potentially. So I'm open to some changes, too. I don't think that anybody in the work group thinks that we did absolutely perfect work on costs or fees or whether we were interfering with people's court rights. You know, some of this didn't get talked about. But that was really the history, was we were trying to get to something else, and this is what we could agree to. And then we thought we'd go back to the drawing board on the other issue. And, in fact, Ivan and I have been working on that for the last couple of weeks.
All right. Other questions, comments? Okay. Thank you each for being here. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on House Bill, which one are we on, 2509? Anybody else wants to testify on that? Okay. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2509. We are not working it today. And we're going to move on to our next House bill. Thank you for joining us.
See you later, everybody. Sorry.
And so we're going to open up a work, or excuse me, a I always want to say a work session.
We wish.
I know. We're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3367. And Beth, if you would tell me a little bit about what the bill does, and I'd like to call up Catherine Daniels from the department to start. Catherine, okay. And what we're going to ask you, Catherine, is if you could just, if you could clarify for us current law, that would be great. And then we'll move into proponents and opponents after that. So,
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 3367 requires proposed or permanent temporary recreational trails freeze by the public on land zone for EFU to go through the conditional land use permitting process.
All right.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, I'm Catherine Daniels, Farm and Forest Land Specialist for the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and with me is Michael Morrissey, our Rural Policy Analyst. The department does not have a position on this bill, but we have been asked by a number of people for clarification on existing provisions in statute and rule that apply to trails. Trails currently in exclusive farm use zones can be reviewed by counties either as a park facility or a transportation facility. A park facility if they're wholly contained within a park, transportation facility if they're linear in orientation and connect or extend outside a park. Both of these approaches to trails require review against compatibility criteria for compatibility with surrounding farm and forest operations.
I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt you. Could you go back, because I was being rude and I was asking the committee administrator a question while you were talking. You said there's transportation facilities and
there's transportation facilities and there's park facilities.
Thank you.
Two different routes for trails.
Okay.
And in exclusive farm use zones, both of those require review for compatibility with surrounding farm and forest operations. Those criteria are found in ORS 215-296. And those review criteria can occur either through a conditional use review process, a quasi-judicial process, or a legislative process, either through a transportation system plan or a park master plan. So those are the different ways that these uses can be reviewed right now. So we don't feel that House Bill 3367 would have any effect on the ground, in that it is asking for the same thing, essentially, a conditional use review, a review against ORS 215-296 review criteria. Those criteria are already in statute and rule and apply to both types of trails. We do acknowledge that there's some confusion. Apparently, different parties have different takes on how trails have been reviewed in the past. To that end, we have put together a clarifying memo that we're happy to disseminate to counties around the state and to trail providers. If the committee also feels it's appropriate, we'd also be happy to do clarification in our rules to that effect. If the bill does go forward, for the record, we'd like to make a note that there is a provision for one type of trail as an outright permitted use in exclusive farm use zones, and that would be under a provision for modifications to existing roadways in existing right-of-ways. So that is currently an outright permitted use, and we would see that as a separate authorization, and that would be something that would continue to be an option for counties, even if the bill goes forward. And that's really all we had to say, unless the committee has questions for us.
Okay. Questions by members of the committee?
Just one. So what do you see happening if this bill passes? Will it you offered to send out a clarifying memo, but does the passage of this bill, as you see it, change anything?
It doesn't change, Chair Edwards, Senator Dembro, it doesn't change any of the requirements, but it may make more apparent to some parties the requirements that are in effect, and it will be more explicitly in what we call the sub 2 list of uses that are subject to county review in statute, whereas the provisions that apply in rule, you have to look at a combination of statute and rule to fully understand the applicability currently to trails as transportation facilities.
Okay. Yeah. Follow up. You kind of referenced that there's some apocryphal information, and I know that you put it that way, that conditional use permits are not being sought, or conditional use hearings are not being held. Is that frequent, or are they frequently being held, or are they more frequently not being held? And I don't know, maybe if there's somebody from Parks, maybe could address that. I'm not sure.
Chair Edwards, Senator Dembro, I'm not sure that we have that information. I think that trails as park facilities and transportation facilities are probably reviewed both ways currently. I don't have a good feel for what proportion of them are reviewed in different ways. I think that the trails that are proposed by land trust community in some cases don't go through any land use review process, but they should be.
So this has been an interesting bill as it's developed over the last week, as my knowledge of current law, and that's why I wanted to start the testimony with you. So we had folks from the farming community that I believe, and everybody will correct me if I'm wrong, I'm sure in the coming testimony, folks from the farming community that have said, look, these trails through farmers, while a trail may go across one willing seller's or one, somebody's willing to allow the trail, grant an easement, whatever you call it, across their property, that also could impact other neighbors, et cetera. So we have a problem with this. We think we should have a conditional use process in place. And then there were other folks, particularly from the park and the recreation communities in Oregon, that have started emailing in the last couple days saying, whoa, this is really going to impact our ability to place trails, particularly voluntarily. Some folks have come forward with a proposed amendment that said, well, if it's voluntary, we'd be allowed to do it. But I can't remember the exact piece of that amendment, but I don't want to get too far out there characterizing the amendment when I don't have it right here in front of me and I'm not reading it. But and so previously, I think folks from the farming community wanted the bill. Folks from the recreational community and some of those interests have not wanted the bill. Pending your testimony, subsequent to your testimony that has clarified the current state of the law, I'm thinking that perhaps the tables may have flipped around on whether or not people want this bill and only with an amendment or not with an amendment. And so I'm interested in hearing from the following panels what everybody thinks about this testimony. So,
if I may, Chair Edwards and Committee, I'm Michael Morrissey. I'm a policy analyst for rural issues in the department. I'm glad that we're up relatively first. We did get asked and we did submit the testimony, and we have worked up some material for counties. I think it's fair to say that maybe a year ago, we ourselves may not have been entirely clear on which this was, and recently we had some new discussions within the department with our deputy director, who's a longtime land use attorney, and we became much clearer upon further review, as they would say in football land, that in fact virtually all trails, either as part of parks or as part of transportation facilities, are reviewable under 215-296, which is familiarly known as a sub 2 use. So partly we want to affirm that right now today we believe that trails are subject to review under those circumstances, and people obviously will express their own opinion.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I'm going to follow up with what you said, because someone asked me the same similar type of question or scenario. But if you have an individual landowner who wants to give an easement, are you saying that that also, because it may be designated for the easement as a trail, that that would then be subject to some type of conditional use permitting? Or can't a landowner outright give an easement on their property?
I cannot answer that, so I won't.
Well, that's a question out there for whoever.
I understand. Przanski, that's how we would interpret it. I have read the proposed amendment that would create an exclusion for lands that were not taken through eminent domain where there's a willing landowner. And certainly if there, a trail were, for example, completely interior to properties like that, presumably it's a linear trail, goes through multiple properties. If it were entirely interior, then there may not be an issue of potential conflict with adjacent agriculture. But if there's a willing landowner and the trail is on the edge of their property and adjacent to another property, there could still be some potential for conflicts. So these are just some of the concerns that we've read in some of the amendments and letters that we have seen.
Right.
So this is just our current interpretation of the way the law is now. There are apparently trails that have been proposed and built that haven't used the process that is in existence.
Chowders, I will say by way of follow-up, and that's a very good question, and I'm not sure that came up specifically in our discussion, but we are pretty confident that whatever our intention was to put out to counties our interpretation of how things are now, based on the feedback that we got, we felt comfortable that if we need to, we could do rulemaking. If you choose to do it by statute, that's, of course, your prerogative, but we think that things are fixable through rule.
Thank you both. I'm going to next call up Tina Galloway, Marianne Nash, and Louise Snyder. You had all signed up under the proponents column. I don't know if that's still proponents or opponents or what, but you're on the same page. You want the same thing, so we'll we'll call you up together.
Thank you, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. My name is Marianne Nash, today here with the Oregon Farm Bureau. And this is originally kind of our proposal arising out of, you're going to hear from some folks from Benton County, but arising out of a number of bike path projects that we've seen having impacts on farmland where we've seen at the very least characterize it as some uncertainty from counties about what type of review, if any, they should be applying to these projects. So we initially brought forth this bill and then had, as you've heard, some conversations with DLCD and other stakeholders to try to figure out what the current state of the law is and have confirmed, as was our understanding and the position we've been advocating for with the counties, that this does not affect a change in law. And the Benton County project you're going to hear about, those folks, they ended up going through the conditional use process and were very grateful for it because there was significant impacts of that project that the landowners without that process would have had no mechanism to address those impacts. But the reason that we cannot support the Dash 1 amendments is that that's just kind of the tip of the iceberg of what we're seeing. One of the really popular methods of constructing trails is the rails to trails concept, which I'm sure several of you are familiar with, that involve turning an existing railroad right-of-way, sometimes they've been not used for 10, 15, 20 years, into a bike path, a recreational trail. And there's one of those projects going on in Yamhill County where I know the county is having the same debate about, okay, what kind of land use process, if any, do I apply to this project? And we've heard from several others, including you'll see testimony in support of the bill, of the original bill, not the Dash 1 amendments, from the dairy farmers, the Oregon Cattlemen's, Oregon Forest Industries Council, and 1,000 Friends of Oregon, all addressing this issue, the bill, and largely one of the conflicts we're seeing is the Rails to Trails projects. And the issue with those is that when you have an existing easement, sometimes going through somebody's property, sometimes adjacent to or abutting several properties, the proponents of the project purchase that easement directly from the railroad, and there's never an opportunity for the landowners to weigh in and raise impacts. And as I'm sure you can imagine, in areas devoted to agricultural use, farming uses include irrigation, tilling, spraying, harvesting crops. If you put a recreational trail through the middle of those operations, the impacts are quite different than a train that maybe occasionally ran through there. I've heard concerns from farmers, and a lot of it just involves mitigation about, okay, is there going to be a fence? Is there going to be some sort of shrubbery buffer? Is there going to be an ability to close the trail when I'm doing really intensive farming operations or moving my cattle to and from? I know the dairy farmers in Tillamook, the trail was going right next to their farming operations, and there was a suggestion of, oh, you could just put up an informational kiosk in the middle of your dairy operation and people could stop and learn. And they're like, we don't want people stopping and interacting with our cattle. and they had operations on both sides of the path, and they were trying to say, how are we going to get them across without intersecting, you know, recreational trail users and bicyclists when the trail is going right through the dairy operation. As you can imagine, that's a lot of a different impact than a train that maybe came through there once or twice a week or once or twice a day, and they knew when it was coming and could plan their operations around it a lot more easily. And an additional issue is just with particularly the Yamhill project. We've heard of a lot of people talk about, oh, it's going to be such a nice place of solitude and enjoying the outdoors and the serene experience, and there's going to be a level of discomfort when they find out, oh, you're actually next to a farming operation, which, as we've heard from the previous panel, you know, can involve a fair amount of noise at odd hours and other intensive activities. So for those reasons, that this bill itself, it's not a change in current law, but current law is the right policy decision. We're not saying these projects cannot go through. What we're saying is that it's appropriate when they're going through farmland to give neighboring farmers who may be impacted the ability to either say, hey, these mitigation measures are necessary. I need some ability to close the trail, to have a buffer, to put up a fence, to negotiate terms of access. That particularly with these rails-to-trails projects, they just wouldn't otherwise have. And I do understand, and we have not received complaints about some of the projects that, for example, Metros and others are doing, I think, because they are undertaking that negotiation voluntarily. But, for example, in the Yamhill rails-to-trails project, that's not what we're hearing. We're hearing they purchased the existing right-of-way. They're going to construct on it, and that's how it's going to be. And the Dash 1 amendments would foreclose the farmers' ability to participate or raise any concerns about those projects. So in closing, we feel that this bill is just codifying and clarifying existing law so that counties don't have any more confusion, that it is the right policy decision, and it has broad support within the agricultural community, because we've seen several of these types of impacts that there's been a lack of clarity about what the process is. Do not support the Dash 1 amendments, but we do ask support for the original bill.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Edwards and members of the committee. My name is Tina Galloway, and I'm with Stallbush Island Farms. We're a family-owned farm and food processing company outside of Corvallis, Oregon. Stallbush Island Farms was founded by Bill and Carla Chambers, and we are third-party certified for meeting the highest standards of food safety, organic, and sustainable agriculture. They started the company in 1985 with two crops and two employees, and in less than 30 years, our company has grown to include over 5,000 acres and nearly 600 local jobs. We have a direct impact on the local economy, including support of thousands of vendors, farmers and otherwise. House Bill 3367 became near and dear to our heart because of the bike path discussion in Benton County. There is some confusion that exists. House Bill 3367 clarifies that a recreational trail on land zoned EFU is not an outright permitted use. The clarification closes a potential loophole that we learned about in our specific circumstance in Benton County. There's ambiguity between OAR 660-012-0065 and ORS 215-213, where the former indicates a recreational path could be approved without meeting any review requirements. House Bill 3367 closes this loop so that it's clear for everybody and there's no dispute at the planning level, at the county level. In Benton County, in our experience, a recreational trail was proposed between Albany and Corvallis that would go right through extremely valuable farmland, some of the most productive in the country, quite honestly. But because of the ambiguity noted, the county wasn't originally sure whether or not they should require a conditional use permit. Fortunately for us, the staff chose to be conservative and require the conditional use permit and the public process. The decision allowed complete public participation, including the participation of the farmers who would have been impacted. 100% of those farmers opposed this trail, and we went to great efforts to educate the Planning Commission about the impacts to farming and our businesses. After a lot of discussion and deliberation, the Commission voted unanimously that the proposed path did not meet any of the land use criteria for EFU land. In this case, the requirement of a permit ensured that high-value farmland was protected as is the intention of Oregon state law. If Benton County planning staff had not been conservative and had not required the conditional use permit, it is possible that this path would have been built and approved without appropriate due process. The county intended to use eminent domain to gain access to all of those farmlands, and they showed a complete disregard for the potential impacts on farming and farmland. If the permit had not been required, a trail would have been pursued that was not in the best interest of the county and would not have protected farmland as the state intends. This lack of clarity and control allows the potential for corruption. So this loophole needs to be closed. In the case of the Benton County bike path, public process stopped the implementation of what was a very poor proposal before it was too late. The same process improvement needs to be made at all levels in the state government to ensure due process and ethics. In this case, there had been a misleading and inaccurate application submitted to Connect Oregon, and they were approved $2 million in funds because of a lack of additional review and process in this case. Stalbush Island Farms did not oppose biking or multi-use paths at all. We support improvements that strengthen the health and wellness of communities, including the protection of valuable and irreplaceable farmland. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Thank you. Go ahead. We're starting to, the clock is starting, it has been advancing. We have 15 minutes. We've got another panel and a half, so.
Okay. She actually, my name is Louise Snyder. My husband and I live on Highway 20 along the path of the proposed recreational trail from Corvallis to Albany, and we were impacted by this proposal. As you've heard from both of the other two speakers, it would have very great impacts on the farmers' ability right to farm, as well as health and safety issues for the path users, and they were quite broad in the risks to the riders. Since HB 3367 would require such a path to go through the conditional use permitting process from its inception, a number of ambiguities in the Benton County path process would be eliminated. Clarifying vagaries in current law would allow input by those who are most affected. In this case, 100% of the family farmers directly affected were in favor of a good bike path, but opposed to the location of it for numerous reasons. It would have forced bike path users also to negotiate what is essentially a busy industrial area, with the farmers being liable forever for unpredictable actions of others. Some commuting bikers testified that they wouldn't use a bike path through farmland, as it would take longer to get to their destination. They would instead prefer a path separated but parallel to Highway 20. The eminent domain issues hit us directly. Imagine our surprise after receiving an offer to purchase a multi-use path easement with a 40-day response deadline to discover that our refusal would make it an eminent domain issue. Mitigation was to be a solution for farmers' concerns. However, the specifics weren't to be disclosed until after receipt of the signed purchase agreement. At the end of the testimony in February, the Planning Commissioner Chair questioned if mitigation would even have been possible considering the range of issues. This opinion and the unanimous denial of the permit application would not have been possible if they hadn't decided to go through the process to be on the side of caution. Perhaps without requiring a conditional use permit on prime farmland projects, there may be a greater likelihood for eminent domain to be considered as the end game. Our farm also had issues of impacting wetlands, floodplain issues, and endangered species, which were glossed over. And we feel those are important considerations, especially when you're changing landscape permanently. It also, defining the process would ease potential conflicts between urban dwellers and farmers and ranchers. In this case, the process became contentious, as we felt powerless to protect livelihoods and lands from assault due to a lack of understanding. This contention was unnecessary, and early solutions may have been found with coordinated efforts of all concerned at the beginning of the process, rather than 10 years later. Consider the time, taxpayer funds, and that could have been used more prudently in that span of time. Prime farmland is a limited resource and should be preserved for future generations. We feel that without the requirement of a conditional use permit, the high-value farmland in the Highway Corridor, Highway 20 Corridor, and elsewhere could embolden other entities to develop other non-farming projects, thus losing the land's great productivity. Thankfully, this precedent-setting event didn't occur this time. With drought conditions rampant in states surrounding Oregon and other parts of the country, it seems prudent to preserve the best farmland, and that's what this is, to feed ourselves, the state, and the nation, now and in the future. For these and other reasons, we strongly request passage of HB 3367. Thank you for the privilege of testifying.
Thank you for your testimony. My only question before we move on is the conflict, Tina, that you cited was between ORS and OAR, something. What were the numbers?
I have to read them off my page. 660-012-0065 was the OAR.
OAR, say that again.
660-012-0065.
Okay.
And ORS 215-213.
And Chair Edwards, I actually have DLCD's memo that talks about that conflict and the resolution of it. If that's, do you okay. want me to?
Yeah, that would be helpful. Thank you. Okay. Any questions for this panel? Any other questions?
I have one.
Yeah.
Or maybe a couple. The Stagebrush, I understand there's 5,000 acres now. Is some of it outside of Benton County? You have other locations?
Yes, that is correct. We farm between Corvallis down as far south as Medford, Oregon.
Right, and you have some in Lane County as well, if I'm
yes,
not mistaken.
Do.
I think I've yep. been by there. Happens to be on a bicycle, but I have been by there.
We're not against bicycles and bike paths.
I understand that. So regarding this particular path that's impacting you in Benton County, I know that there's another one that was, it may be part of the same one that they're looking at that I thought went more north to south out of Monroe up toward Philomath or toward Corvallis. It may be a different rail that has been condemned. So the one that you're talking about was also a vacated railroad or
no.
not?
Excuse me. In this case, they were not able to obtain permission from the railroad to work within the existing railroad right-of-way.
Okay.
So they had been turned down by both the State Department of Transportation and the railroad and decided to go what they considered to be the path of least resistance, which
okay.
was eminent domain of farmers.
All right. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you each.
Thank you.
Next, I'm going to call up. So we're going to have we have two more panels, not necessarily everybody that has signed up together. Don Horton, you're from over the hill, over the mountains. You're not over the hill. You're from over the mountains. So in case you need to get on the road, why don't you come up and testify because you're not here all the time. And then MG Devereaux from the department. You did not sign up, but I think there may be some questions for the Parks Department. So if the two of you could both come up, I understand that you're not here to testify together per se. And then we'll have one more. I think we have one more panel after that. So.
Thank you, Chair Edwards and committee. I'm Don Horton. I'm the executive director for Bend Metro Park and Recreation District. And just a little bit about the district. We primarily serve the city of Bend, but our boundary is larger than the city, so we also have land within the county. And about 50% of our land base is within the city limits, and about 50% is outside. Connecting a lot of those parks is trail systems, and we have about 65 miles of trail. A lot of that is within the city limits, and some of it is outside. So we have both issues across EFU's own properties and some that are not. What I want to talk a little bit today about is there is a difference in EFUs on lands on one side of the mountain and the other. And where a lot of our EFU zone lands is nothing more than a pile of rocks. And some of those we actually have built parks within EFU zone lands. We have one large sports complex that is on EFU zone lands, and we have plans to connect that park with trail systems into the urban area. So one thing I would just caution is that there really is a difference between the type of EFU lands that we're talking about, but whatever law changes that we propose will affect all of us equally, you know, on both sides of the mountain. One of the trail systems that we're also looking at in the region, a regional trail system, is along the North Unit Canal. So this is across, you know, a large spans of EFU zone properties, and it is on an irrigation canal where we would use the ditch rider road that currently exists for the trail system. That would connect Bend with Smith Rock. Also, it could connect Bend all the way to Madras, and then there's another effort to connect Smith Rock to Prineville. So you have multi-jurisdictions. You have multiple counties involved in this. You have multiple cities involved in it, which will not deal with EFU zone lands. It would only be within the county. And so it makes it even more complicated. I think the issue with us, though, is the difference between how the law may be currently written, as you heard testimony, that you currently have to get a special use permit or a conditional use permit. But practice over the last 40 years hasn't necessarily been that way. I think it's been all over the map. Some agencies have required it, some have not. In Central Oregon, it's typically required if it's a part of a larger park project that is within the county, they require a conditional use permit. But it has not been typical to require it if it is a trail system. So here on the North Unit Canal, as an example, you have an existing easement. It's on federal property. Some of it's federally owned property. Some of it is a federally held easement that we would be using in that case. And so we would be subject to the same kind of land use laws and going through the conditional use permit, which would be a longer process and more expensive process for the taxpayer to be able to get through that on an easement that already exists. Also, I just want to talk a little bit about the public process that I think is pretty typical in our industry, certainly the process that we use in Bend. Is any time we plan for a trail system or a park, we go through a design process that includes all of the neighbors and the greater community at large. And in that design process, it's an opportunity for us to look at different design options, be able to address issues, and it's also an opportunity for us to look at mitigation measures in the case that it has to be mitigated. You know, I'm afraid that if you have a law that requires a conditional use permit, that mitigation is going to be handled through that permitting process, and once you get the permit, you're going to forge through and build the trail however you see fit. I think it would be less opportunity for mitigation with a conditional use process than how it currently happens today, that allows us to sit down with all of the parties involved and to work out solutions on both design and mitigation. So I know in our case it's worked well. We've also never had a case, I think, where opposition to a trail system hasn't been able to be resolved. And I grew up in a farming community myself. My family for generations has made their money on farming practices, and so I've had the opportunity now to sit on both sides of the fence, and I believe that both can coexist as long as you're willing to sit down with one another and work out the issues. So we are in support of the Dash 1 amendment. We're not in support of the original amendment, the original bill, but with the Dash 1, we are in support.
Actually, I'll ask you a question afterward. Go ahead, MG.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, my name is MG Devereaux, Deputy Director of Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. The department is officially neutral on this bill. I was here today to see if there were any questions. We've heard some concerns from some of our stakeholders and constituents and can answer questions from the state park perspective.
Senator Devereaux.
Yeah, I do have a question. So, and this came up already, and the previous testimony also touched on it, just the question of what your understanding of the current practice, the past practice, has been about the use of conditional use permits. And then I also have a question about, you know, we always have concerns in advance of projects But I'm wondering how those concerns have actually played out in those trails that have been in existence. I mean, the potential conflicts between the users of, for example, rail-to-trail or other trails and farmland, you know, what the experience has been.
Chair Edwards, Senator Denbro, State Parks manages over 1,000 miles of trail throughout the state of Oregon, and several of them are very long linear trails. The clarification from DLCD is a good clarification. However, it is not one that has been followed through all of our practices as we've moved forward. I do want to say that the department has always committed to a robust public process. As Mr. Horton remarked, a lot of our planning up front involves the public coming to our design alternatives and looking for ways that we can make a trail happen successfully. Those are not always easy conversations. The Banks Vernonia Linear to Trail is a good example. It took almost 30 years to fully complete that trail with lots of conversation with the public. I think the concern that we've heard from some of our constituents, and if we were to apply this to some of our trails that may cross county boundaries, that would have two competing conditional use permits as we move from one county to the other, or a time component that the trail plan may have been created a decade ago, and as we start to get funding in place and start to actually do some of those works, whether or not a clarification as offered by DLCD or this bill would restart the clock on some of those processes. Those are some of the things that we're going to go back and look for in our agency, as well as we manage grant programs to local communities through the Recreation Trails Program and other park development grants. We would want to make sure that those projects that have already been granted or in process meet the required land use to make sure that we could go through with those projects, and that may cause some uncertainty on those projects or our ability to deliver those on time.
And if I could follow up, and in terms of the issue of complaints of existing trails after they've begun to be utilized?
Senator Edwards, Senator Denbro, it really is a case-by-case basis. I think the department has a very good history. We hear from our constituents that there's a good history once trails are developed. We fully recognize that there are potentials for conversations with neighbors, especially when it relates to agricultural concerns. 2 years ago, the agency was lead on an Oregon Solutions project to try to get some of the agricultural community and the parks communities together to talk about how to move through some of those issues. I'd also point to Senate Bill 204, which the governor was putting forward in an effort to try to get some of the conversations about how changing land use patterns affects agriculture and other types of use. And we would certainly welcome that conversation to see how we could resolve some of the concerns from the agricultural community and still have trails and parks be a vibrant part of those communities moving forward. I can't say that every trail is, once it's built, is a rousing success. There are always challenges that we work through with neighbors, but generally our linear trails and our long trails have a very good record of being able to work with communities to resolve issues, mitigate concerns, and still have benefits not only for neighboring properties from an agricultural or use standpoint, but also the community benefits back to recreation and transportation health.
I can add a little bit of different perspective to that, if you'd like. One of our biggest concerns...
Please, because I'm running out of time. If you could keep it brief.
Okay. Well, one of our biggest concerns before a trail build is trespass. And so whenever we're designing the trail, you know, we try to mitigate for trespass and locations that trespass may take place. The reality is, after the trail is built, you have very, very little trespass. Another issue is probably more relevant in communities like Bend, where we have a lot of easements that currently exist for irrigation. Right now, if there's not a trail on that, there are still trail users on that. And so what we're able to bring to the process is enforcement along the trail. We bring the dog rest stations. We bring caution signage. And so that, you know, we're opening it up to the public, whereas before you have a trespass issue that if the public is allowed to use that trail, it becomes less of an issue than it does when it's not being allowed to be used as a trail.
Interesting. Okay. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Our final panel is Stephanie Redman, Robert Spurlock, Randy Tucker, and Mark Landauer. I think two.
Mark had to leave.
Okay. and I think two of you are both from Metro, I think.
I'm from Metro.
Okay. Go ahead.
Chair Edwards, Senator Dembro, staff, thank you for the opportunity to be here this afternoon. In the interest of time, I'll be very brief. Stephanie Redmond with the Oregon Recreation and Park Association, executive director there. We are a 501c3 nonprofit statewide association of park and recreation professionals, volunteers, and public and private organizations with nearly 1,000 members across the entire state of Oregon. We focus primarily on education, networking, and advocacy. We have testimony on file that can go into greater detail and address some of the concerns that I would have addressed had we had more time. But in the interest of cutting it short, I would just say that the recreational trails, as you've heard, create some confusion with current statute. Not all recreational trails are rails-to-trails projects. They're not all transportation, part of transportation facilities. They're not all parts of parks systems. Some of them are purely recreational. So we believe there is a gray area in there. You've heard the confusion regarding past interpretation and whether or not all trails would require conditional use review. You've heard the acknowledgments of the various interpretations of the statute and the administrative rules already. I must say that our association, on behalf of our members, opposes House Bill 3367, along with Metro, along with the Oregon Parks Association, Trust for Public Land, Special Districts Association of Oregon. Unfortunately, Mr. Landauer had to leave. We oppose that because it overturns the practice that has been in place for decades, as you've heard. It challenges and, in fact, even overturns voluntary trails easements process and acquisition that has been successful in hundreds and hundreds of miles of trails across Oregon to date. And it adds a burden to both the public and private sectors moving forward in trails development. We feel that the most prudent and fair approach is to adopt the Dash 1 amendments, which would say that recreational trails are an allowable use except in cases of eminent domain, which obviously is controversial, has created a lot of controversy in Benton County and elsewhere when it's been used for other types of projects, not even trails projects. We all know the politics of that. Our point is, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. We have 30-plus years of practice that, by and large, has worked very well. We do acknowledge Benton County is an unfortunate example of a process that is not typically used. We certainly don't encourage that to be used, and as you heard from Mr. Horton, that is not the norm. But we feel that the Dash 1 amendments do address the sponsor's concerns and certainly address the concerns that we have on the park and recreation side. Thank you for your attention, and I'd be happy to address any questions you might have.
Okay. Thank you, Stephanie. Go ahead.
Chair Edwards and Senator Dembro, my name is Robert Spurlock, and I'm a regional trails planner with Metro. I know it's 5 o'clock. I'm here to explain Metro's, the way that Metro typically goes through trails. Would you like me to give my 2-minute testimony?
Yes, please.
Okay, thank you. Trails are an extremely popular piece of our state's public infrastructure for both transportation and recreation in both urban and rural areas, and the public demand for these facilities is enormous. According to the Outdoor Recreation Survey, the Oregon Outdoor Recreation Survey, walking on local trails is the second most popular outdoor recreation activity among Oregon residents. So for decades, the state and local jurisdictions have built trails in farm zones by obtaining easements on a willing seller basis. Metro has a policy of not using eminent domain for our trail development program. Several trails have been built across EFU lands over the last few years and have not caused or experienced conflicts with abutting farm uses. These include some of the most popular trails in the state, such as the Banks Vernonia Trail in Washington County, the Casadero Trail in Clackamas County, and the recently built Stafford Basin Trail near Lake Oswego. These trails are developed through years of partnerships and collaboration between government agencies, landowners, advocacy groups, and citizen stakeholders. Metro's Regional Trails Plan and Regional Transportation Plan provide a vision of a connected network of trails, of which many pass through farmland. And I do have this map here that shows that in more detail. The development of these system plans includes a robust public engagement process, including stakeholder engagement, public open houses, online public comment tools, and finally adoption by Metro Council. Individual trails within these system plans are also master planned in detail beyond the system planning process. So that process includes its own comprehensive public process with conversations with neighborhood associations and interviews with neighboring landowners, for example. So one example of a recently master planned trail that Metro did was the West Side Trail, which when built will pass through EFU land in Multnomah County. The planning process lasted for this trail lasted over 2 years and included 6 public open houses, 6 stakeholder committee meetings, 10 presentations to neighborhood associations, 3 public comment periods, and adoption by 6 local and county boards and councils. This process is typical of other planned trails in EFU land and provides ample opportunities to address neighbor and landowner concerns. So the map here shows Metro's regional trails plan and highlights proposed trails that would pass through EFU land. Developing these trails will provide numerous benefits, economic development benefits, public health benefits, active transportation, and air quality benefits. So we urge you to adopt the -1 amendment to facilitate the construction of trails through collaborative processes like this while providing a more rigorous process to protect farmers facing eminent domain. Thank you.
So my question for you both is, okay, I understand you don't like the underlying bill. You like the -1. If the whole bill goes away and doesn't move forward, is that less preferential than having the -1s? Or do you like really affirmative, like you want the -1s? I'm just trying to understand like where exactly everybody is on this.
Sure.
Or are the -1s a compromise in your view?
It is a very complex issue, and I appreciate the attention you're giving to it. Our preference is for the -1 amendments. We had clarification from DLCD yesterday that they feel all trails projects should be going through conditional use review. Practice has not been the case, as you've heard already, for more than 30 years. So we feel that the -1 amendments, to some degree, maintain what has been common practice. They clarify for counties and land use review agencies, as the proponents would like to see done. But they also mitigate the extreme cases of acquisition by eminent domain, which I totally understand is a concern in Benton County and elsewhere when it happens. And again, let me stress that, as you've heard, that process is not the norm. It is very unfortunate that it has occurred, but that is not the norm of how trails are typically developed.
And I would just add that our agency feels a strong mandate from our constituents to implement this plan. We've heard this for decades over and over, and we feel that the -1 amendments would facilitate that more easily.
Mr. Chair and committee member, Randy Tucker from Metro. I just wanted to answer sort of your specific question about the three. There are three possibilities on the table: the -1 amendments, nothing, or the underlying bill. And I think that's the order in which we would prefer.
Or some yet.
Well, those are on the table, you know.
Yeah.
And certainly we.
Amendment that's spinning around in my head or a committee member's head.
I
don't have any specific ideas.
That's fine. I just want to agree with Robert and Stephanie about supporting the -1s. We certainly would not support the bill moving forward if nothing happens. As you've heard, there's been ambiguity we've only heard in the last several days from DLCD what they believe the status quo actually is. And I think, you know, there would be room for some conversation about what ought to be, but we certainly support the -1 amendment moving forward.
So rank order, -1s first.
Nothing second.
No bill second.
Oppose
the bill as presented. Okay. Got it.
ORPA concurs, and I believe special districts would as well. They were proponents of the -1 amendments, and Mr. Landauer asked me to convey that specifically.
Okay.
For
you. Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Thank you each for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
I think we got through everybody that signed up. I thank you for your patience. When we scheduled these public hearings last week, at that time, we had not anticipated how lengthy the first bill that we did today was going to be. We thought that was going to be just, you know, all this consensus and everybody loves it. And so clearly it wasn't. So it took up more time. So Thank you for your patience. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3367, and we are adjourned for the day. 7, and we are adjourned for the day.